Good morning, Ithaca, Watkins Glen. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is David Levitsky. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
It's good to have you here on the show.
Nice to be here.
Good, good. So the way we start the show, part of the show is modeling how to get to know each other over across differences. And okay. So I've brought in 350 people cross-section, not of every dimension of this community, but a lot. And so who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, I feel like I've been here forever. I came up in 1968 as a postdoc at Cornell. And I've been a professor there ever since, so I've been part of the community for a mm-hmm, long mm-hmm. time.
Sure, sure.
I came out of the 60s, the civil rights movement, which was a wonderful time, where we got thrown in jail and got beaten up and was part of a larger movement that really felt wonderful.
Uh-huh.
One of the major ideas through that time was the concept of a one world concept, that there should be no division between people, whether it's your color, whether it's skin mm-hmm. color, whether it's
sure.
your gender, whatever. We were all the same. And that was a great concept during that time. And then as the movement transcended into a more black power movement,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We whites who belonged to that movement knew they didn't have to tell us to leave. We knew it was time for us to leave, so
right.
we left that movement and picked up by the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam events, which mm-hmm. kind of rekindled that kind of a solidarity with people of similar beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that finally went its way, I was kind of left here in Ithaca not having anything.
Uh-huh.
So I was looking around for something. Being trained in science, I actually started before that. I started questioning my Orthodox Jewish background,
mm-hmm.
Primarily the theism that's behind it. I drifted away from classic Judaism, but I was left with a void.
Yeah,
I had no identity, essentially, in that
certainly
in that
no
idea.
Community.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. I started searching around for that, and came across Kol HaVarim for a couple reasons. One is we had kids, and I wanted to give them a sense of at least the history of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And give them a sense of what the holidays are and how they're practiced. And I found myself very comfortable with Kol HaVarim, which is a non-theistic Jewish group. It sounds mm-hmm. paradoxical.
You describe most of the Jewish students I went to school with in the late 1970s who'd come out of the 60s and I mean, as
yeah.
teenagers, as
right.
young people, come out of the 60s and 70s and were secular
right.
in orientation.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. yeah. Yeah, when did you encounter Kol HaVarim?
Well, it started in 1999, and I was there at the first meeting,
yeah.
and I've been there ever since.
Yeah. I think I heard about it in 2001. I think it was
just
after.
Just shortly
yeah,
after.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah, yeah. Okay, let's cut to some music. And what should I play for starters here?
How about It Ain't Necessarily So?
Okie doke. And this is a recording by Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. And we're going to start into the trumpet piece and play through the major part of it.
The things that you're liable to read in the necessarily so. Little David was small, but oh my. Little David was small, but oh my. He fought big Goliath, who laid down and died. Little David was small, but oh my. Yes, Jonah, he lived in the well. Oh, Jonah, he lived in the well. But he made his home in that fish abdomen. Oh, Jonah, he lived in the well. Little Moses was found in the stream. Little Moses was found in the stream. He floated on water till old Pharaoh's daughter, she fished him, she says, from that stream.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. They tell all the children the devil's a villain, but it ain't necessarily so. To get into heaven, don't snap for a seven. Live clean, don't have no fault. Oh, I take that gospel whenever it's possible. But with a grain of salt. Methuselah lived 900 years. Methuselah lived 900 years. But who calls that living when no gal will give in to no man? What's 900?
Sermon to show.
Ain't necessarily so.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is David Levitsky. So David, I just want to ask you, what kind of an Orthodox community did you come from so that you would feel or have you would feel the license or the privilege or the freedom to take off on this adventure of being with these causes? And so what about it, or did you have to rebel in a very strong way?
Well, I grew up in a little farm town in southern New Jersey.
Aha.
And
not your stereotype of a Jewish community.
That's right. Right.
Not in the U.S. So, anyway.
Right. But the South Jersey has quite a large community of Jewish farmers.
Sure. Yeah.
It's a small, primarily Gentile town, but there's a small population of Jews who lived in that place. Mm-hmm. And it was very tight-knit, where everybody knew everybody else, and you couldn't do anything because somebody else would see it. So it was hard to make any statement outside of the ritual. If you did, it was picked up by everybody. So I was essentially a closet atheist for much of my young life, although the friends that I hung around with, we used to get together on Saturday nights, and we used to go to each other's churches and talk to the ministers or the priest or whoever's officiating and ask them questions about the theology, because we were all challenging basic theology at the time.
Sure.
And that was very good.
Raised a question.
Yeah. We were constantly raising questions. Didn't have any answers, but we raised lots of questions.
But that
allowed me to be closeted for quite a while. I used to go to services, do everything you're supposed to do. But I remember having to test my faith there once by being in the synagogue and cursing just as a test.
Right, to see if you could do it.
And wait, well, not that I could do it, that I couldn't get struck by lightning.
Oh, I see.
Because I was always told, you know, there's respect to the things you don't do in the church or in the synagogue. So I remember being very scared after that, despite the fact that I was intellectually trying to convince myself that there was no supernatural being out there that was going to
zap me.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And it's at that point you're not trying to convince your head, you're trying to convince your gut.
Yes.
Right. And that's a
intellectually
process.
I was convinced, but it took a while for me to emotionally get past that point.
And it's funny because it's one of those tests that on an individual level works, but on a community level can be perceived as insulting.
Yeah.
And both are true.
Yeah.
Both are true.
Right.
And if done in a way which shows that it's not an insult, can be a great act of respect, even if you're cursing.
But I think I could only do it because I had people around me, friends, who also were thinking in similar lines.
Yeah. So you didn't. Okay. So it was the friends who thought like you that you felt support from, rather than the freedom of people who were looking after you and trusting that you would figure it out.
Yeah.
Right. So they weren't trusting you would figure it out, but they agreed with you.
Right.
Was the more important part. Okay. Yeah. I grew up in a different situation where people were more trusting that even I could be incredibly offensive by community standards. Right. And because I was trusted, they would go with me to places that they wouldn't necessarily go. Like I sang the prayer of a worker, which Kilapa Yun recorded, which is about taking a gun for the revolution. You know, in my church, in Spanish, in the late 1970s, because this was a church that was part of the agrarian revolt of the 1870s. Mm-hmm. So 100 years before, they had been part of an insurrection to challenge the economic system. And they could actually look at me with that kind of loving kindness. Yeah. We all have to kind of grow through these moments.
Right.
So how did you come together as a group to found Kol HaVarim?
Well, we all, I think what brought us together was education of our children. We all had this idea that we wanted to give our children some sense of history of the Jewish people, some sense of the philosophy, the historical philosophy that Jews have had for a long time. And give them a sense of pride, because we live in a non-Jewish community. Where we wanted our kids just to be proud to be Jews. And And all those things came together, and we created this little organization, which has been existing now for quite a while.
I want to talk a little bit more about that organization, but I want to just explore. So you see this as a non-Jewish community.
Yes, yeah. It's a secular community.
It is. Well, yeah. It is.
At least from my perspective, it
right.
is.
It's probably 15% Jewish, the county.
Probably.
In terms of the population. And most of those are secular Jews. We're probably a Christian minority county with about 45% identifying as Christian, but only half or less of those actually belonging to a congregation.
Yeah.
And within the Jewish community, probably, if you take out the students and you take from both Cornell and IC, you probably only got, you know, maybe 1,000 members of four different congregations in town, maybe five, depending upon how you slice them up.
Yeah. But I question whether they're truly secular Jews or not, because where I see problems come up is, for example, the defense of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I think Israel has not done the nicest things to the workers on the West Bank, and I've seen, both on campus and off campus, when people try to speak against Israel, criticize them, that the secular Jews take the position that, no, it's wrong, you can't speak against Israel politically.
That may be true on campus. The ones I see off campus are not the secular Jews. In fact, the ones who are defending off campus are almost always tied to one of the three or four groups in town, religious groups in town.
Yep.
So that's interesting, because I don't spend that much time on campus anymore, so I don't see it from that angle. So Kol HaVarim came into being in large measure to provide a place for cultural resonance for the next generation.
That's part of it. The other aspect is just to give us a place where we could talk about things, where we could read books and criticize books and talk about how you can be secular in our society.
In effect, be secular Jews with a strong emphasis on literacy and debate and conversation.
Exactly. Right.
Cool. About how big is Kol HaVarim?
It's pretty small now. We have about 15 families that belong.
And it's been bigger than that at various points.
It's been
probably closer to 25 or 30, I would have guessed.
That's right, right. Yeah. It has, and it depended on the number of children
that are
available.
Yeah, and with most of these small communities where a large part of it is the children, they do fluctuate widely.
Yes.
And children have a way of in this community more so than other parts of the country. In most of the country, people live within 5 miles of where their mothers are.
Yeah.
But in Ithaca, if you want to go on and make something of your life, the opportunities aren't so great here. So it means being further away. So the communities lose people.
And we find it's hard to reach out and find the young families that are coming in. Let them know that there is an organization that will supply the education, the Jewish education of their kids without the theism.
Right. I guess what let's explore this question of theism and atheism. Partly because I have a very kind of an odd take on it, which you might expect. I haven't. What is the problem with theism? And then the flip side, what is the problem with atheism?
I guess I don't see it between these two. I was trained as a scientist. Mm-hmm. I was trained in observables. Mm-hmm. I was trained to think very rationally based on experience and observation.
Mm-hmm. And clearly,
theism goes beyond that.
Yeah.
And that's where I have the problem.
Right. And I guess, for me, I was trained also in, I have a background in biology, anthropology, and ethics from Cornell, as well as in economic development. And economics is arguably whether or not it's empirical or not, given how things are measured. The empirical piece of science makes a lot of sense. But there's no room in science for aught, except as a probability, not as a moral claim. So my problem with atheism is that, as in terms of science-justified atheism, is that with just science, you don't get to morality. You have to have a structure of understanding of moral commitments.
Sure.
And for me, what I see with most theists, that's what they're committed to. Yeah. And they're not committed to empirical claims, but they're committed to moral claims.
Yeah, I'm not sure I totally agree sure. with you here
yeah.
because...
No, this is not about agreeing. This is a conversation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because humanism
yeah.
Is totally devoted to morality, how people mm-hmm. relate to one another. Mm-hmm. And I am now totally convinced that you can be a very good person, very highly moralistic person, and not having any faith at all that there's any spiritual being out there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's not inconsistent.
No, yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I would hold the same is true for a theist. And both a theist and an atheist are equally capable of being profoundly human if they are humble. And actually, that's a word based in part out of the word it means to be human. And it means to not claim more than you could possibly know. And most theists get into trouble when they start speaking for God rather than of a reality or something that exceeds their capacity to understand and control. And most scientists get into trouble with the same stuff when they start making claims beyond which for which they don't have any evidence. And so for me, the odd place that I came to is that theists and atheists who are humble have a whole lot in common, and those that aren't are out of bounds because they've made claims that are way in excess.
Sure. I couldn't agree with you more in there. But there are issues that separate the people who have a scientific view of life and from those mm-hmm. who have a spiritual view of life.
What
and
are
that's
those
where
issues?
The division...
But what are the issues? Because I'm not sure there are issues. You're telling me there are issues, so what are
well,
they?
Well, as far as I know, and I'm not a student of religion, but I have studied various mm-hmm. religions, every one of them do not allow you to take your own life. If you know
yeah,
exception.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And there's a reason for that. There's a philosophic reason for why that's important. In almost all the religions, you have to be able to make the choice to accept the religion or deny the religion.
Because it's not, is,
if
well,
you don't have that choice,
right? Yeah, yeah.
You know, then you get into to some problems here.
Well,
so
you get into all ideology and coercion,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
right. So
yeah.
all religions have that as an essential ingredient,
and it's not only a choice about the religion, but about the degree of observance.
Yeah, the degree of...
And the nature of one's
right.
loyalty. All those are choices.
Right. But they converge when you talk about life. Taking of a life, preventing a life,
mm-hmm.
They become spiritual, not biologic.
What makes them spiritual?
Spiritual because there is a very common belief that only a God can give you life or spirit or... something larger than you
something
can give you this
something
life.
Beyond your comprehension and control.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And therefore you have no right to take it away.
But that doesn't follow. Not from most of my experience.
But in my experience, I know of very few religions that sanction taking your own life.
It's a particular crime, or crime, I shouldn't say crime. It's a particular sin in Judaism.
Oh yeah,
it's more ambiguous in Christianity because some behaviors that put your life on the line to be taken, you can choose to take. They would be defined as suicidal because you know death is the consequence, and yet you are encouraged to take them. It's a much more subtle conversation,
yeah.
and then I'm thinking and what I'm wondering. See, I believe that these are really important questions, and in most of the religious and one of the one of my great frustrations politically is that in the first effort to get healthcare passed in the early mid-1990s, we had done a lot of grassroots bioethics work out in the Midwest, having these conversations about how people wanted to live out to the end of their lives when these things were complicated. And what people wanted was a really good amount of communication among themselves, the people important to them, and their physicians and healthcare providers. But it was a lot about communication and collaborative decision making, and not so much about my individual right to decide in kind of a defiant individualistic way. So that's where I see religious traditions are oftentimes more sensitive to the community context of decision making, and sometimes secular traditions get stuck in a certain kind of individualism which doesn't take into consideration the community context. This is taking us down a slightly different path. I want to go back, though, so you can respond to that, but let's go back to the decision process.
Again, I think it drifts a little bit from the main thrust, but I think again, I'm not an expert in this, but from my knowledge, taking your own life or even preventing life from occurring, abortion, for examples. These are highly religious questions.
Yeah. Abortion was made illegal in the 1870s, but largely by efforts of the American Medical Association to establish their professional credentials. Yeah. And most religious people didn't have a problem with pre-viability or pre-quickening abortions, and they were quite common. And there was not a religious issue. It became a religious issue when we had a fight over middle-class values and control of women's bodies, which began as a liberal issue, not as a conservative issue.
Right. but the issue is still there, and you still have this conflict between the secular view and the more religious view of whether abortion is moral or even suicide is moral.
Right, but it's extremely complicated because it was the religious leaders in Chicago, religious leaders in New York, who were helping people get access to safe abortions even before they were legal.
Right.
And Connie Cook was advised by an Episcopalian. I mean, we have tremendous religious participation.
Oh, yeah. Look, it's totally integrated with politics. That's what determines everything here.
Which is the art of working through differences.
But I would still maintain that this essentially is an old argument and philosophy of free will, all religions require that you have this ability to choose or reject the religion that you practice, and that's where you get in many issues get you into problems when you think that you have the choice to make these issues.
So, what is the nature of human choice?
Wow.
I don't see the connection in what you said to what we were talking about.
The connection is that you have to be free to make the choice. If you say that you have no choice, you're Protestant, you're Christian, you're Catholic, because that God made you that way. You have no choice
there
to,
is
to
that,
judge
that, 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 okay. that, and that is a part of Christian theology. There's a secular determinism and there's a religious determinism, and they work much the same way.
Yes, right. Yeah. So if you said that you wanted to deny, you wanted to just do what you want, then you're not part of this realm anymore.
Right. You're a nihilist and you're outside, but nobody is a part of the science community or a part of any other community who says they're just going to do what they want. We all have to make our institutional commitments in order to survive.
Right. But if there was no free will, and I am leaning toward that view philosophically, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. we are simply products of our experience and our biology.
And determined either completely, hard determinism or soft determinism?
Hard determinism, okay. I actually ran a course with some professors in philosophy in the law school, of all places, on free will. Mm-hmm. So we've gone into this in some depth. Mm-hmm. And this idea that you can, that you can't choose to take your life is pretty strong in most of the these religions.
It's strong in most cultures.
In most cultures, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and sure. But it's also been practiced in most of these religions and most of these cultures in indirect ways. It's practiced with physicians or with healers who are provoking it. It's in conversations and judgments.
But it's not practiced overtly in no place that I know.
I guess it's not. Well, let me tell you a little story. There was no overt practice of gay and lesbian lifestyles in the congregation that I grew up in. But there was a couple of men, one of whom, and they were both born in the 1890s, and a couple of women who were both born in the 1890s, who lived their lives together the whole time. And the men, one was a superintendent of schools of a neighboring school district, and the other one was a farmer. And they would sit and worship, and they would even hold hands. It was just accepted that that's what these guys did. But they came of age and were in relationship long before the intense homophobia that has taken over this country. And the woman was a postmistress of King City in 1915, an attorney, mayor of King City in 1930, lived, couldn't be on the governing body of the congregation, but said, they'll never meet without me. And so she went in and she took the notes, and until they dragged her into a nursing home because she couldn't live independently anymore, she was the secretary because she had no man to represent her. And she wasn't going to let him get away with that. And so we had these practices, were totally open. You know, we had practices, and in a similar way, we had practices around end-of-life care that were totally open, but they weren't flagrantly flown like flags. And so I'm just questioning the newness of it all.
I think, again, you're talking about the contemporary politics of these events, and I'm talking more about the philosophic meaning underlying
these issues. And because empirically the philosophical claims you're making are in excess of the reality of the experience, I think you've stepped outside the bounds of science.
Philosophy is outside the science.
And that way, as a person of faith, I want to keep it more grounded in practice. Keep it more grounded in what people actually do, rather than in theorizing. And that my particular tradition is heavily based on empiricism, as well as what they call practical theology, which is very different than philosophy or systematic theology. It's an interesting nexus. We just walked up to it. What is the value? You're about to bring a program this next weekend to the community on do you believe in the right to die with dignity? Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is an issue I think is finally coming to the surface, and it emanates from much of the discussion we just had. Mm-hmm. The right to die. My wife and I both believe very strongly that we do not want to see, we don't want to suffer at the end of life. Mm-hmm. We don't want to see our family suffer. Mm-hmm. I suffered through the death of both my parents, and it was horrible. And it was not only horrible for my parents, but it was horrible for the rest of the family who had to cope with this.
Yeah.
And there's an increasing movement now in the United States to accept death with dignity, to mm-hmm. accept physician-assisted suicide. I think Colorado on Tuesday just voted to have death with dignity.
Oregon's had it for years.
Right. The number of states have been increasing. This organization, we have a woman whose name is Julia Hanway, from an organization called Final Exit. And there are a number of national, international organizations that provide information about how you can die with dignity. Mm-hmm. Their particular bent is political, to change state legislatures mm-hmm. to allow physician-assisted suicide. And that would be a great move, I think, both to allow the individual the choice to die mm-hmm. without pain or suffering. And I think it would be a movement forward for everybody if that occurred.
And so what's the forward part?
The forward part is just to allow people to mm-hmm. die. Mm-hmm. You can't die by yourself. It's illegal to commit suicide. It is, and we are saying no. That shouldn't be illegal. It shouldn't be even a stigma on you.
Right.
We should create the organizations. Scandinavia's had various techniques for quite a while now, mm-hmm. And they have created a whole system of checks and balances mm-hmm. because it could get out of hand.
Right. Right.
But we could create such a schema
right.
to not allow somebody to kill their parent or whatever mm-hmm. people were worried about.
And let me just, so this program on Do You Believe in the Right to Die with Dignity, a discussion of peaceful self-deliverance, end of life, options, and physician aid in dying with Speaker Julia Hanway of the Final Exit Network will take place on Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at Lifelong in Ithaca.
Yes.
And it's sponsored by Kol Havarim, the Finger yeah. Lakes Community for Humanistic Judaism, and Final Exit Network. And we talked about Kol Havarim, so I'm going to put in that plug now, and then I want to continue on some of these issues.
Sure.
Kol Havarim, you can find out more about this humanistic Jewish congregation at Kol Havarim, KOLHAVERIM.net. Kol Havarim, KOLHAVERIM.net. And make your acquaintance, because this is a beautiful community serving a very, very, I think, a much bigger niche than they even realize. I've always wondered why the message didn't get out better about Kol Havarim, because this is a huge potential community. As long as these are secular Jewish folks who are seeking community, there are lots of secular Jews who are intensely individualistic, and the community piece, that was their way of reacting to religion, was to become hardcore individualists, which has its own piece. And actually, that observation is the segue to the next part. What do you envision as the process for making end-of-life decisions? This is where I've done most of my work, is what does the actual empirical process of end-of-life decisions look like?
I'm not certain, as I know exactly what
okay,
you
I'll
mean.
Okay, I'll tell a couple of stories, and then you
okay.
will know. For example, one of the first... back in the 1960s, there was a very famous dual suicide between the president of Union Seminary and his wife, and they were both diagnosed with illnesses that they did not want to go through the suffering, and so they suicided. They did this. Their beliefs in the right to choose. So there is a religious belief in this as well, but the thing is they didn't bring the community along with the decision. And so when the community learned about the decision, it had a devastating impact rather than an affirming impact on the community, and it affected the spirit of the seminary for decades afterwards. I was there in the 1980s, and the echoes of that not having been a good decision process were still in the seminary, even though people affirmed their right to make that decision. In the same way, I have worked with many families who are going through the same process, and you can choose to starve yourself to death. That's something you can mm-hmm. choose to do, and the hospitals can't force feed you. And that's actually how many people effectively mm-hmm. commit to suicide. It can be very painful, but it also can be very an act of complete will. When it's done in conversation with the people around you who love you, so that they know why, and their needs for you to be alive or willingness to let you die are clear, and you've worked through the conflict. Beautiful stuff. And what I ask for people to do is not to make their end-of-life wishes known, but to make how they want to live till the end of their life known.
I totally agree with you. But I think the best example of this process that you're trying to get at is the process with which Sandy Bem died a couple years ago. Because that was beautiful, because the family was in on the decision. They celebrated her life before she died, and it was totally accepted by everybody, and everybody felt good about it. But she and her husband elected to die at a certain date, and they went through the procedure fully observed by the local legal and medical people here, and I thought it was a very beautiful process.
Yes, and that kind of transparent, open process is historically what happened in communities prior to our medicalization and professionalization of healthcare. And so we have destroyed a lot of the capacity that we had for these more sensitive, individually sensitive, community-based decisions by the professionalization and the politics of professionalization that has so controlled our lives.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with you. The problem there is that it's not accepted by the community in general.
Therefore, if one wanted to
commit suicide, it would disrupt the community in the same sense as your story unfolded.
Well, yes, but the thing is what's happened since that story, and having worked with end of life. I mean, I'm a clinically trained chaplain. I worked at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, and I worked at Lenox Hill, and also New York Hospital a little bit, and a residency in Missouri. Families who are going through a long-term illness are almost always ready for this kind of conversation. It's a matter of just broaching the subject, and they actually do often have it. So the communities, in most instances, are already there. What's happened is when you kind of ambush people who weren't ready, who hadn't been kind of walked through the awareness, and I'm talking about concrete decisions, not policies, and you're talking more about policy climate, which would tend to reject it. If we were to hold our policy conversations based on the speaking of people who've lived through it, both good and bad experiences of how end-of-life decisions were made, I think we could very quickly get to the place that you're talking about. It's when we have people talk out of their heads, not grounded in experience, that we get into really deep trouble. And that's whether they're religious or non-religious, because they're not grounding their comments in the ambiguity and the complexity and the pain and the joy and the hope that comes from a Sandra Bem story. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I don't think we're that far. I think you've got a great issue. The timing is fine if we hold on to the honest expression of what it's like.
But we have to begin talking about it, and that's the whole function of having Janeway here.
And there are those of us in this community who have talked about it for 20, 25 years. It's not new, but it's great that you are bringing it out in this particular way. And it's the religious community that's actually done a lot of conversing about it, probably more even we're about a 45% religious, and I mean non-religious atheist. Community. We're a Christian minority county, from the best as I can figure from the numbers. And we're of those non-religious people, probably half, which is like four or three or many times the national average, are atheists. So there's a huge pool of people, but they're not organized. They tend to be individualists. They tend to be like herding cats at the universities, which is partly a reflection of the cultural temperament here, and not a strong sense of community. So pulling in what you are talking about is really, really important.
We hope so. And I think there are a lot of people that would like to talk about it and don't have the vehicle to talk about that. And New York State is wrestling with these questions right now. And I think we have to get the policy straight, as well as talk to people about their own individual choice and what their choices are.
And because I am an empiricist, those policies need to be built out of the accumulated experience of people's having made those choices. So,
fortunately, we are accumulating experience as more and more states, as more and more countries are accepting at least physician-assisted suicide.
Yeah. And for me, the safeguards are, have they talked with their children? Have they talked with their friends? Is everybody on board with it? Or if those who are not on board with it, have their objections been addressed, whether or not they can be fully addressed or not? And this process of decision making, we can get it right, I think, with end of life care. Mm-hmm. We can get it right. We messed it up with abortion.
Yes.
And women have ended up owning child rearing because we haven't created a kind of, what is the context in which we decide to bring to birth or to abort a pregnancy? What is the context in which we decide to be sexually active? And what are we responsible for? And those cut across gender. And we have not had those open conversations. And we have suffered enormously as a country. And there is no monolithic religious or non-religious approach to those issues. They require incredible conversations. And they're the same problem. As you raised at the very beginning.
Yep.
Let's cut to some music, and then I want to come back for our closing conversation.
Okay.
What would you like to play next?
How about John Lennon?
Okay.
Imagine.
Here we go. Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is David Levitsky. So, David, the way we close the show is with a question about your own personal practices. And it's, you know, what do you do to take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically or viscerally? And on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual, regular basis? And how do you know you need to take care of yourself? When do things kind of fly out of control? Yeah.
Well, my subject matter is nutrition.
Yeah.
And nutrition is all about how to take care of yourself.
Yep.
So I'm into this world 24/7. I envy my more orthodox friends who can take one day a week and just put it aside. Yeah, and just say, I'm going to use this for reflection. Mm-hmm. I wish I could do that. My life is just too filled with things for me.
And you haven't been able to kind of supply the discipline to
exactly.
make it happen.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And I realize it's my own weakness, but I just can't seem to do that. And so that's part of my problem. On the other hand, Kol HaVarim allows me, because there are certain holidays that are mandated.
Uh-huh.
You know, you celebrate this holiday, you celebrate this, and at these holidays is when we reflect, because we talk about the origins of where they came from, mm-hmm, and allows us to do the kind of reflection I should do at a more regular level,
right,
to see the larger questions that are involved. So I wish I had more time, but I do have an avenue that allows me to express these kinds of feelings and make the kinds of inquiries that I need.
And so that helps me to understand on an intellectual and somewhat on an emotional level, but more seasonally, like with Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur,
exactly. Yes.
Perhaps Simchat Torah,
right.
Passover.
Yeah.
But what do you do more on a daily basis? How do you take care of yourself?
Yeah. Well, physically, uh-huh. I don't take a car. I ride a bike.
Uh-huh.
I make sure our meals are good.
Mm-hmm. You're the cook in the family?
Half the cook.
Half the time. The cooking. Yeah,
half the time.
I am the cook in my family. That's just generally been my role.
Okay. I that's about my reflection. I don't have time to reflect a lot, from a philosophic view.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily what I'm talking about. Meditation or singing or walking, bicycle riding, all of these activities have a way of inducing an effect in the body, which is very similar. In terms of the blood chemistry and the blood pressure. So you're describing those things. You're bicycling daily because you've got to get to and from campus.
Right.
And oftentimes when I ask this question, I'm pushing people to think about what they're doing, which they may be doing without ever having really reflected on it in that way, bundled it in that particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for asking the question in that way, mm-hmm, is to offer examples to people who may be struggling for finding a balance. I'm extremely busy. I like to try to walk 3 miles a day. That happens not all the time, but it happens enough of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to walk it at a pace which most other people don't want to be near me. But it kind of gets it going. I like to read the newspaper at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'll spend my daily meditation is to spend an hour with the New York Times or some other reading, and I regularly read some religious sayings across many different traditions. But my time is in the morning, and it's work time, but it's also meditation time.
Yeah, and so it is with me. I'm a very early riser, and I find I get my best work done early in the morning because what I'm doing is writing, which is a very lonely thing, but I spend most of my time.
It's a lonely thing, but it cannot be interrupted.
Yeah, but it allows you to get to that space that I think you do with meditation and many of these other things. And so because I'm always writing scientific articles, but my mind is in that kind of space where you think about things in a larger sense. I do that very regularly, I think. And that has a religious in a way, a religious context to it in right. that.
Right. Most people don't realize that the word religion comes from a Latin word which means to religament. And the ligaments are what hold our bodies together. And so religion is what holds the whole thing together. Yeah. So I, as a social scientist, what I would do to kind of test people's religious identities was I would say, what did you do when your life fell apart? How did you put it back together again? And that would tell me what their religion was. Even if their nominal religion was Christian or Jewish or Muslim, mm-hmm. what they did would tell me what their real religion was. And it's also similar to the definition of tikkun olam, which is repair of the broken world, the shattered glass, the mm-hmm. shattered orb. And so when you use that term, there is a religious quality, and yeah. scientific understanding is a method towards that. Yeah. But the values are not scientific. They come from outside empirical observation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good to get to know you, David.
Okay. It's fun to be here.
Good. Good. You had brought another song that we may close with, and it's Atheists Have No Songs. And what I'm wondering, do you want to make a comment on that for the closing?
No, this is it's a humorous song, but it reflects the kind of idea that atheists are somehow scared of the ultimate death, and we have no foxholes, and that indeed atheists don't have any music in their lives, and that's not true.
That's not true at all. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, here, let's go. Let's see if I can get this queued up right here.
Christians have their hymns and pages. Hava
Nagilas
for the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Romantics play
Clair de Lune.
Born again, sing He is risen. But no one ever wrote a tune for godless existentialism.
For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing a song of faith in their songs.
They have a rule.
The He is always lowercase.
Some folks sing
a bacchantata. Lutherans get Christmas trees. Atheist songs add up to nada. But they do have Sundays free.
Pentecostals sing.
They sing to heaven. Coptics have the Book of Scrolls. Numerologists count. They count to seven.
5, 6, 7.
Atheists have rock and roll.
For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing a song of faith in their songs.
They have a rule.
The He is always lowercase.
Atheists
don't have no songs.
Christians have
their hymns and pages.
Hava Nagilas for the Jews. Baptists have the Rock of Ages. Atheists just sing the blues.
Catholics
dress up for mass
and listen to Gregorian chants.
Atheists just take a pass.
Watch football in their underpants.
Atheists
don't have no songs.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen.